There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, a story of friendship, fraud and fine art with Orlando Whitfield and his new book, All That Glitters.
Orlando Whitfield graduated from Goldsmiths University in 2009. He started dealing art while still a student and worked in and around the art market for 15 years. His writing has appeared in the Paris Review and the White Review. And today we're here to talk about Orlando's debut book, which is All That Glitters, which talks about those years in the art world. Orlando, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, can you just say something about your background and particularly your relationship with your father and how that influences the career path that you take?
Yeah, so my father was an auctioneer. He worked, I don't know if it's a badge of honour or the opposite, but he, I think, is the only person still to have worked at all four major auction houses, but had, you know, mostly in kind of managerial roles. But I was, I grew up among and alongside beautiful things, and my father and my mother both instilled in me a love of these, of beautiful things and understanding them, care for them and their history. And so I did an art history A level, which was a sort of strange thing, but I had a teacher at school who had gone to Goldsmiths, or had at least, I think, done a master's at Goldsmiths. And he got me quite excited by minimalist artists like Carl Andre and Donald Judd when I was sort of 16, 17. And I started to kind of, I used to call it brain fizz, when, you know, I'd encounter ideas in that kind of aesthetic realm that really challenged me in a way that I'm not saying that I hadn't been challenged before. I was a lackluster student for the most part, but this was a challenge in a way that felt genuinely exciting. And so the idea of going to Goldsmiths was firmly planted in my head by that teacher. I also slightly wanted to go to Goldsmiths to piss my father off, because it was modern art and art theory and all the things that he had a profound kind of distaste and dislike for. But I figured that if I went there, I could perhaps learn how to argue with him, because I wanted to, you know, I was always gripped by the ability of people like my father, but I now know there are many other such people in the world, most of them absolutely full of crap, who can stand in front of something and say, now that's a good thing. And I didn't understand how they were coming up with those judgments. And I wanted to equip myself with the tools to make those judgments and to, well, to have arguments with my father, basically, and more crucially, to win them. So that was really how I ended up choosing to go to Goldsmiths to do the degree I did. And it was fantastic.
Well, you talk about later in the book about, I mean, and of course, we should say the caveat this with the, you know, I guess people that have studied, you know, Renaissance art and, yeah, antique furniture and stuff have sort of more ability to sort of compare and judge things in that sort of way. But you talk about that idea of like value judgment in terms of the sort of contemporary art market later on in the book. And also that you never really get to the bottom of that question you were just asking yourself, because really it sort of boils down to the person that shouts the loudest.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, obviously, a lot of markets are made by people who, you know, have a high platform and a loud voice. But I think places like the art market, where really the decisions of a select few influence a multi-billion dollar market, And that's just, this is, you know, only to speak of the contemporary art market. That feels to me, yeah, that was a lesson that it took me quite a while to learn. But one which, yeah, I wonder whether I learned it before I wrote the book or whether that was something I realized retrospectively. But anyway, that's, it's something I now know. Useless, of course, given that I no longer work as an art dealer. But
so you end up at Goldsmiths, and while there you meet another student called Inigo Philbrick, who you become fast friends with. What were your first impressions of it?
I mean, it, as you'll know from the book, it took me a long time to actually even, well, for either of us to have a conversation with the other. He was an odd figure, aloof, almost kind of aristocratic in some ways. He knew everything that we, you know, certainly in the first year of our Goldsmiths course, he seemed to know everything already. He could do the thing that I wanted to do, which was to have arguments or at least debates with clever people and come off sounding as clever, if not smarter. And so my first impression of him was a fascination. And that was an emotion or at least a feeling that remained for a very, very long time.
And so through Inigo, you meet some of the sort of demimonde of the art world of London. There's a great scene in the book set in the house that he was staying in Great Russell Street next to the British Museum, where generations of young artists have lived. He comes from an art background himself. Both his parents were in the art world. And you end up basically doing a couple of fledgling art deals together. So tell us something about those first couple of deals.
Yeah, they were real seats of your pants kind of stuff. We knew someone, or at least Inigo did, and I came to know someone who, a man called Robert McPherson, known to everyone, certainly back then. I don't know about now, but as Uncle Poison, or just Poison. And so he had been a curator at various places, but in the late 80s, he had given a show, one of the first shows she ever got in the UK, to Paul Arago. Recently deceased, of course. And this was, you know, Rego had been very much in the shadow of her, slightly more of her husband, basically. I mean, it was still, yeah, Britain in the 80s. Victor Willing, who was a much more prominent painter at the time, less deservedly. And Rego did a show with Robert at a gallery on Rosebery Avenue in kind of in the Bloomsbury area, Clerkenwell kind of place. The Air Gallery in, I think, 88. And there were, you know, Robert had, I think, invited a lot of his friends to that show, and the works were very reasonable at the time. And I think quite a few of his friends bought them. And Robert had bought a small work for himself. And at around the time that Inigo and I first started talking about putting together some art deals, Robert had, I think, approached the much more recently deceased Marlborough Gallery. I mean, we're talking 2 weeks since it went under, less. And Marlborough Gallery, I think, said that they could get him, you know, £3,000 or £4,000 for this small watercolour. And so he said, well, you know, to us, he called us. We had our company, which was called I and O Fine Art for Inigo and Orlando. But Robert almost immediately rechristened it Idiot and Oaf Fine Art. But regardless of what he thought of our promise as art dealers, he very kindly gave us this work to sell, and via someone we knew at university who was the son of a Spanish, he was Spanish, and his father was a dealer in, I think, Madrid. We got introduced to a dealer in Lisbon who was Rego is a complete, you know, she's the art rock star of Portugal, and we figured we might be able to achieve a slightly better price for the work if we were to sell it directly into Portugal. And we were right. And we were able to sell this thing very dodgily in cash to a bloke we'd never met before. And it involved quite a lot of hijinks and japes. But it was an extraordinary experience, and one which I can still, I mean, at least I think I can still remember viscerally to this day. It was heady and wildly good fun. And I was transfixed not only by Inigo as a person at that point, but by the promise that this could be something I could do for the rest of my life. Because, of course, you know, unlike a lot of people who go into art dealing or to go into working in galleries, you know, most, I think a lot of people have no real idea of what that's like. Whereas because both Inigo and I had very different but art world families, I knew that this was actually something I might be able to do for a living. And I couldn't quite get over how fun it was, at least to begin with, I suppose.
And so, yeah, you mentioned in the book that, like, you know, most people do not understand how the art world operates and think. And, you know, I would have thought this myself before reading the book, that, you know, you have a young and up and coming artist at Goldsmiths or Central St. Martin's, and they put on a student show, and then maybe that gets seen by someone who owns a commercial gallery, and they might put on a show at that gallery, and some people might buy their art. And then one day, maybe a museum will pick up one of their pieces and it'll enter a permanent collection. That's how the art world works. So, like, what is a dealer? What does an art dealer do? How does that student's painting end up eventually in the hands of some, like, Russian oligarch?
Gosh. Well, I guess I should start by making a distinction between a gallerist, which is someone who shows that student's work for the first time, and a dealer, who I guess is someone who sells that work after it's been sold for the first time, so it works on the secondary market. And so, I mean, I guess we could take, for example, you know, a London gallery like White Cube, which obviously features somewhat in the book. You know, so someone like Jay Jopling would take, I don't know when he first met Damien Hirst, but Damien obviously had something of a profile after, I mean, everyone, I think, in 1988, when Hirst graduated from Goldsmiths, everyone thought that he was going to become a curator, because he put together this exhibition, this now legendary exhibition in the London Docklands of most of his, or a lot of, at least, his peers, the peers who went on, some of them at least, to become known as the YBAs, the Young British Artists. He put together this show, which was, yeah, it was called Freeze, but not like the magazine and the art fair. Jay, I guess, would have met Damien Hirst and offered him a show, and would have sold the work to various people, hoping to sell it to, I guess, what one might term good collectors, i.e. people who are building significant collections, and thereby, you know, work by young artists, as Damien was at one point, go into a collection like that and both enhance and become enhanced by the works that are also owned by that wealthy person. And so over a period of time, if enough of these objects are squirreled away by the right people, the work will go up, you know, the work will go up in price, but the work will also go up in value when and if it is tested at auction. So say 5 years after the first White Cube show of Damien Hirst's work, someone like Charles Saatchi might test the market to see, you know, everyone has told him that his, let's say, his shark piece or whatever it is worth 10x what he paid for it. He doesn't know that and, you know, doesn't necessarily want to sell it to another rival collector, perhaps. But you can test the market by putting things into auction and seeing what the public appetite for these things are. So I guess that's the chain from art student to oligarch, is, you know, that I guess is the sort of traditional chain, that the work increases in value in a public sphere, i.e. in the auction rooms, and then eventually, you know, becomes, and of course, this, as I sort of make the case in the book, I think that the whole idea of work as an investment opportunity, or, you know, as of these works being in any way kind of, you know, investment assets, investment grade, really came to the fore with the YBAs. That was not something that really was prominent, at least in the public imagination, before. But nowadays, that, you know, and certainly at the beginning of the time that I was working with Inigo, when he, and I guess maybe we should circle back to the timeline of stuff, but when I was working with Inigo in around kind of 2013, 2014, that was a time when you could, well, not everyone could, but people were buying works more or less direct from artist studios who had just left the Royal Academy or the Royal College or Central St. Martin's or Goldsmiths. And those works would be sort of flipped straight into auction, and you'd sell them for, you know, you'd achieve a price of sort of 10 or 15 times your initial investment, but within months. And that would tank artists' careers almost immediately, because lo and behold, 3 years later, when that work came back to auction and it had previously sold for 300 grand, it now sells for 15. And of course, no one has any faith in that artist's market anymore. So there is a sort of a heat and a speed to the market these days, which has ruined many a career far too quickly.
Well, related to that, you mentioned a couple of times in the book that, you know, people say that the best thing about the art market is that it's unregulated, but also the worst thing about the art market is that it's unregulated. So what does that tend to mean in practice?
That tends to mean, I guess, a lot of the things, I mean, I hesitate to use words like insider trading and price fixing, but, you know, for example, I could get together a group of three or four interested parties, dealers, collectors, even just people who are, you know, have some spare money. And we could say, all right, let's look at these pictures. You know, this artist has a, I mean, better if the artist is dead, let's preface this by saying, because then you have a control over the supply of the market, right? So we could say, okay, there's this guy, Jeff Glitters, and he's a fantastic painter. He's very unheard of. Let's, between the five, six, seven of us, however many, you know, we kind of get together and we buy a bunch of these works. And then one or two of them could be put into auction. And the whole of us as a consortium could then go to that auction, bid the price of those works up so that the market starts to think that these are paintings, that these are artworks, which are more valuable than they used to be, or than anyone had kind of thought of. And so people will be interested in buying those. But by that time, you've kind of sitting on a big cache of these artworks ready to sell when the market's gone up. Now, that's not the sort of thing you can do in a, you know, standard financial market. That is price fixing, and you're working on privileged information. That's the sort of thing which is run of the mill in the art market. I mean, you know, there's no real regulation to speak of which would stop something like that happening.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Orlando Whitfield, and we're talking about his book, All That Glitters. And Orlando, yes, let us get back to the timeline. And Inigo has, you mentioned Jay Joplin and the White Cube Gallery. Inigo starts to intern there, eventually ends up working for Jay in a capacity whereby he's put in charge of a gallery. Jay Joplin wants to get into the secondary market because something else you talk about in the book is the sort of weird etiquette of the art market, where it doesn't look good for somebody who's a prominent gallerist to also be a dealer. So basically, He sets up this gallery, Inigo's working there, and then you go to work for him as well. So tell us something about this time.
Yeah, so when Inigo and I left university, I went off and worked in publishing for a few years, and Inigo went off to work for White Cube, as you say. But in around 2011, early 2012, Jay Jopling backed Inigo in a gallery called Modern Collections, which was meant to be, and indeed was, a kind of a New York Upper East Side style secondary market gallery of a kind which was fairly normal in New York, but it was the first of its kind in London. And about midway through 2012, I had been quite unhappy in my role, in my job in publishing, and had been looking around for another job in publishing, but I hadn't managed to find one. And Inigo very kindly offered me, or at least, he offered me a job as publications manager at this gallery, Modern Collections. And I didn't really think that this was an actual job, because he was doing two catalogues a year, and that would take me, you know, no more than a week or two to work on. I mean, it was really not a huge amount of work. And so he eventually kind of said, oh, well, you know, come and do the exhibitions as well. And as I swiftly realised after that, there really weren't exhibitions either. I mean, we did do some exhibitions, but they were mostly to do with what Inigo had to sell at that time, what he wanted to get out of, as it were. And I would have to kind of come up with a, you know, curatorial rationale for, you know, two or three completely aesthetically and conceptually opposed artists, just so that we could kind of put them in the gallery so that Inigo could sell them at the same time. But, you know, it was an extraordinary education in how the murky upper echelons of the art market works. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to write this book if I hadn't worked for that amount of time in and around an operator like Inigo. And yeah.
You actually eventually step out on your own with another friend to open a gallery. Tell us something about what happened in those times.
Yeah, I worked with someone called Ben Hunter, who is a dealer still and a good friend. And he and I lived around the corner from each other in Southeast London. And we're both working in kind of the Mayfair, St. James's area for me, for Inigo, and Ben for a dealer of mostly kind of bronze 19th century sculptures, Rodin, that kind of thing. And I think we both had ambitions beyond what we were doing. Both of our employers were interesting people to work for, let's say. That is not to say that Ben's employer was in any way criminally inclined, I should underscore. But we ended up having these long conversations. We would walk to work once a week together and have a kind of fried breakfast on the way. I mean, we still do that, but we used to talk about the idea of setting up our own gallery. And for a long time, it was a sort of pipe dream. And then my mum was living in a building, and she told me that the building had these offices on the ground floor, sorry, on the first floor, that the landlord wasn't going to, they weren't going to renew the lease because they wanted to get, they had to get everyone out over a sort of certain period. And so there came this opportunity to have a space for not very long, but for not very much money in a very good central London location. And so we kind of leapt at it and suddenly found ourselves not just working for art dealers, but becoming gallerists. And it was, we opened the gallery with a show of an artist called Christopher Page in 2015, and went from there and worked together for two or three years, and it was great fun.
Meanwhile, and jumping forward a little bit in time, Inigo has gone from success to success and now has his own galleries in London and Miami, and then one day he disappears. Tell us why.
Yeah, so in October of 2019, a lawsuit was filed against Inigo by some German business partners of his, some people called Fine Art Partners. They claimed, as later turned out to be true, that Inigo had been, I mean, I don't quite know what word to use here. The dealings that they had over a long period of time had been fraudulent on Inigo's part. And we're talking a huge amount of money here. I don't know quite what, I can't recall off the top of my head what the number was for Fine Art Partners, but in the region of kind of $20 million. And essentially what came to light over, as you say, Inigo, he fled from Miami to an island nation called Vanuatu, which is near Fiji in the South Pacific, which, you know, I mean, in terms of optics, is not great. It doesn't scream innocence if you run to a South Pacific island with no extradition treaty to the nation in which you are being asked to appear in court. But while he was there, and I by this point had kind of had a breakdown and dropped out of the art market in kind of, I don't know, about 18 months before this. So I was actually doing a master's in conservation, in art conservation at the time. And Inigo would kind of ring me occasionally from his hiding place for a long time, not really telling me where he was. But by that point, there was quite a lot of press coverage of his disappearance. I mean, you know, not just in the art press, but in, you know, everywhere from Bloomberg News to the Daily Mail. And by the time the pandemic hit in March of 2020, my conservation course had obviously been cancelled. It was a practical course and couldn't be taught. So I was at a loose end, I mean, as we all were, but I was basically just sitting on my sofa with nothing to do. And Inigo kept ringing me and just, you know, chatting. And I thought this was just him ringing me for a chat, just to kind of tell me funny stories. He was a funny man. And, you know, I hope that's something that kind of comes across in the book. It's, you know, he was an excellent raconteur. And so I, you know, entertained these stories and these phone calls for a very long time, despite the acerbic nature of the time difference. You know, I would have to, all these conversations happen pretty much with me in bed and him, you know, with my morning coffee and him making an evening cocktail in the South Pacific. But nonetheless, after a certain amount of this back and forth, Inigo said to me that he would like me to write about what he had done. And to that end, he sent me this vast tranche of documents, emails, spreadsheets, et cetera, which, I mean, did not encompass the totality by any means, but encompassed a large cross-section, shall we say, of what it is that he did. And that essentially was to be selling the same artwork to multiple different people. And because at that very kind of heady upper level of the art market, quite a lot of people aren't actually buying a whole painting. So they're buying half or quarter shares in a painting, but also they're buying paintings which they never actually intend to hang in their homes, or sculptures they never intend to install. These are purely investment vehicles. And so that lends itself to a fraud scheme like the one Inigo perpetrated, in that he kept physical control of these paintings. So it was very easy to say to person A, would you like to buy this painting? And they say, oh, yes, very much. Yes, thank you. And here's $10 million. But then he says to person two, would you like to buy this painting? And person three, and person four. And so eventually he was selling kind of, you know, 200-300% the same painting. And if you've ever seen the Mel Brooks film, The Producers, you'll know how that ends.
And so you mentioned that you left the art world, or you left being an art dealer because you had a breakdown. I just wondered, like, where you are now. Like, obviously, this book is written now, and it's being published. You mentioned that you were doing a art conservation MA. I guess that means that you get to get a painting with some children's watercolors, as you were aghast at somebody else doing at some point in the novel. So tell us where you are now.
Well, I mean, I'm afraid I'm no longer working conservation. I didn't manage to get the master's because the course was cancelled, and I by the time it was back up and running and I could have gone back, I was writing this book. Writing is the thing I think I've always wanted to do, and so that's what I'm going to try and do from here on out. I've got an idea for another book, but for now I'm kind of, you know, I'm going through the publishing rigmarole over the next, I don't know, 6 weeks to 2 months in the UK, and then a bit more in the US at the end of the summer. But I very much hope that this is not going to be my only book, that this will be one of at least a few.
So I've been talking to Orlando Whitfield, and we've been talking about his first book, All That Glitters, which is out now in the UK from Profile. Orlando, thanks so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.